Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and a man with a stun gun in his bag made it all the way to the gate at Kennedy Airport yesterday before getting arrested. Did you hear about that? Last week, an undercover TSA agent with a fake bomb hidden in his pants got past Newark Airport security. And starting in late April, we will no longer have to leave our pocket knives behind. You all carry pocket knives, right? When we fly somewhere. But we will still have to travel with tiny little bottles of shampoo. Where's the logic in that? Joining us now to explain what's going on with airport security and if there's going to be a real shift soon in the overall TSA strategy is Harvey Milach, professor of sociology and metropolitan studies at NYU and author of Against Security, How We Go Wrong at Airports, Subways, and Other Sites of Ambiguous Danger. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great. Thanks.
So why is the TSA, first of all, relaxing some of the rules about what we can take on a plane?
So a first thing to understand is that the rules that we have came about through a kind of composite set of arrangements. The public demanded things. Politicians demanded things. And the experts saw ways of doing things. And it just sort of – it's the way the earth cooled quite a bit of it. Some things make more sense than others. Controversies about scissors, for example, should they be allowed or not allowed? Members of Congress, the Senate, spoke about scissors. And so all of these things percolate into the circumstances we now have.
But how does letting us bring small pocket knives on planes reflect a larger strategy? I mean, reports this week were that aviation security leaders are moving toward a more individual risk-based system of passenger screening, using more data to pinpoint likely threats as opposed to scrutinizing everyone. How does the pocket knife thing fit into a risk-based strategy?
The pocket knife thing, here's the story. The key thing that was done to increase airport security was to lock the pilot and co-pilot off from passengers. That having been done, about 96% of any possible intervention could result in anything positive was already done. For a long time, people within the security establishment have understood that a lot of the intrusions, including checking baby milk and all the rest of it, really didn't amount to much. And so now what you're seeing, I think, is a way to mollify some of the complaints and resistance about the fact that so little of it makes sense. I can give you one dramatic example. In fact, the target, the big target, are people waiting to go through security. So security has, in fact, created the target. None of those people have been checked. And there are often more people waiting to go through security than will ever be on an airplane. So that gives you an idea of how the entire apparatus has a kind of arbitrary and, as some people call it, theatrical quality to it.
I just want to come back to the sealing of the cabin doors, sealing off the pilot and the co-pilot for a second, because allowing the pocket knives on, the small knives, has raised the ire of some 9/11 families, and it is eerily reminiscent of the fact that on 9/11, small knives or box cutters were used to take over a plane. But you're saying it's fundamentally different because they were able to use those instruments to get into the cockpit.
Yes, that right, and turn the planes themselves into instruments of mayhem. And that's the primary catastrophe, was that they got control of the plane. Within security, they don't say this out loud, but they said it to me. What the primary goal is to not let anyone take down a plane and use it for nefarious purposes. If you have to lose a passenger, this is what they cannot say. Or a flight attendant, then that's a different category of loss than losing control over the plane.
Listeners, any comments about the emerging rule changes as you've been hearing about them in the media, or anything else you want to say about airport and airline security right now? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9222. 9692 for Professor Harvey Milach of NYU and author of Against Security, How We Go Wrong at Airports, Subways, and Other Sites of Ambiguous Danger, 212-433-9692. And another thing that they're going to do is to begin to try to differentiate between trusted travelers. I guess that's going to be an official category that we can apply for, trusted travelers who would breeze through security and those who would receive more scrutiny. And not surprisingly, civil liberties groups are questioning this move. How would you get to be a trusted traveler?
Well, you already can become a trusted traveler. There are programs that are already in existence, and you have to apply for it, and you have to not have a criminal record, and you have to have a stable history of employment. There are criteria like that, and then once you get it, you're kind of set. What worries me about it, besides there's the civil liberties issue, the other issue is that it will mean that the untrusted travelers, which will just be a vast assortment of people who don't fly very often, for example, will have to continue this process of being subjected to these inspections and delays. And so it will weaken the constituency, in effect, for better design and more efficient and more sensible airport security mechanisms.
Because you'll have at least three categories. You'll have a few people on the no-fly list. You'll have a few more people on the trusted traveler list. And that vast mass in between who just showed up at the airport because they fly once in a while.
That's right. They've been screened as being powerless.
What would you do instead?
Wow. First of all, I would rely much more on intelligence. If you have to have this apparatus, then the first thing I would do is bring in a design team. What's extraordinary about our country is that a new toothbrush doesn't come on the market until there's been a vast amount of effort of figuring out what people's pleasures are, how they work in real life. This apparatus that we see has been done overwhelmingly without any expertise in how you set up a better experience. And in fact, the very word design is anathema to most of the security system, including the people in Congress who watch over it.
By the way, did I miss a category? And I want to make sure to be thorough about this. When I said some people would be on the no-fly list, and then you go to the vast category in the middle. Is there also a kind of additional scrutiny list that's short of a no-fly list?
I don't know what their intentions are, but the issue of profiling already exists. And some people, like, for example, at NYU, my Arab-looking students report that it is an absolutely routine part of their flying experience.
Let's take a phone call. Scott in New Jersey, you're on WNYC.
Yeah.
Hi, Scott. Scott, you're
Good
on
morning.
The air. Hi, you're on the air. Scott, go ahead with your comment
Hello.
If you can hear me. All right, we'll try to come back to Scott. Vincent in Warren, New Jersey, you're on the air. Hi, Vincent. All right, I guess we're having a little phone problem here. To book a flight, particularly international flights, you already have to give a lot of information, like your birth date and passport information, which is information that's already shared with the Department of Homeland Security, isn't it?
Yes.
And so I read that the government will look at data that airlines and travel agents collect from us beyond birth dates and passport numbers to things like our itineraries or if we're on some kind of group trip. So what, if you're traveling to Pakistan or something, you're now going to be scrutinized more?
I would suspect yes, and I would also suspect you already are.
As in the case of the profiling of your Arab-looking students that you were describing.
Yes, indeed.
Let's try Scott in New Jersey again. Scott, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Hi, we got you. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I work for the government. I fly armed frequently, and I feel like I can offer a little insight into the difference between, say, pocket knives and baby formula. The issue with pocket knives is that after 9/11, everyone saw that, you know, the plane had been hijacked using box cutters. But since then, there's been a change in public consciousness. People no longer are going to let a plane be hijacked with pocket knives or box cutters because they realize that once that happens, they're going to be killed on that plane. hijackings before that, usually the planes weren't used to crash into things. So now it's not such a concern that people have pocket knives just because the passengers themselves won't allow it to happen. And again, the cockpit's sealed, so you can't get in there with a pocket knife. Mm-hmm. But the issue with things like baby formula is that they could be bomb components. And with a bomb, it doesn't matter what the passengers or the flight crew do. It can bring down a plane on its own.
I understand the distinction that you're making, even though it's counterintuitive. And yet, why would anybody need to carry a knife on a pocket knife on a plane? I mean, they'll give you a plastic knife to cut your food, presumably. Who needs a pocket knife on a plane? What are we going on, a camping trip up there?
Well, I can't tell you. I can just tell you that I'm sure a lot of people show up at the airport without thinking it through. And that's probably what they're thinking. Mm-hmm. They're just saying that it was not necessary before, mm-hmm. and it's not really necessary now.
Again, Scott, thank you very much. Good luck up there. Peter in Riverdale, you're on WNYC. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I was listening to your show, and I was just wondering, why don't we adopt the Israeli model for airport security here in the United States? Instead of everybody getting patted down, everybody removing their shoes. I'm no expert, but from what I understand, Israel, passengers pass through multiple security interviews, and only a small percentage are actually patted down.
Are you familiar with the Israeli model, Professor?
Yeah, a little bit. So a number of things. First of all, the Israelis are not shy at all about ethnic profiling. They engage in it massively, and there are clearly two categories. There are Jews, and then there are non-Jews, and then there's subcategories, Israeli citizens, non-Israeli citizens. The other thing is that Israel is confronted by a much less large flying population. So there is just a kind of hardcore feasibility, whereas there are virtually no flights within Israel, for example, because it's such a small country. So they only have to deal with international flights, whereas we have a vast – it's our sort of automobiles now.
We're just about out of time. But on that point, there are global security standards – and there are international, or I should say national, security standards that vary from country to country, like we were just describing what they do in Israel as a particular example. European officials are raising privacy concerns about some of these new categories that the U.S. is considering implementing. So how different is the European mode of airport security in just a few seconds? And is there any such thing? Should there be any such goal as global or international standards, or does it all just depend on the country where you board the plane?
There are international standards, and in part they're negotiated among authorities, but in part that negotiation occurs in the context of U.S. domination, because unless an airline conforms to American standards, their planes cannot land in the United States. And because the U.S. is absolutely so dominant, both in the production of airplanes as well as air traffic in general, the U.S. standard tends to be the global standard.
All right. Changes afoot on what happens in the air. Harvey Milach is professor of sociology and metropolitan studies at NYU and the author of Against Security, How We Go Wrong at Airports, Subways, and Other Sites of Ambiguous Danger. Thank you so much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, a post-Sandy zoning dispute hits the South Street Seaport. Stay with us.